This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. And now we'll move to Christina Mora. Christina is a sociologist from the University of California at Berkeley, and we're very happy to have her. Thank you for joining us, Christina.
Thanks for having me.
It must be a very interesting time to be an expert on ethnicity in the era of Trump. So tell us, what have you been seeing since Trump took office? What's been grabbing your attention?
Very many things. I think, several questions. The biggest issue that has been sort of, I've been thinking about as a scholar, but as an individual, in general, is just sort of the question of immigration, the whole sort of dynamics of immigration and race politics and how sort of it was used in an unprecedented way, during his campaign, and how it's sort of at the forefront even of his presidency. Issues much more about who belongs, who doesn't belong, who are the bad guys, in the nation, he just broke all the rules about sort of PC race, racial politics. And I think that has struck me a lot, not just for sort of campaign presidential rhetoric, but also the way it actually trickles down to real policy. So, his talkings about DACA and whether to put it on the chopping block or not can't be separated from his arguments about sort of Mexico bringing in its criminals and rapists and things of the sort. So in many ways, it's been really interesting, mainly depressing, and mainly as a, professor on campus at the University of California, also a call to action in many ways and thinking about the ways the University of California can protect all of its students, regardless of documentation status.
Yeah, the politics have been very hot at Berkeley, haven't they, in the past few months?
Oh my God, yes.
Can you give us a little rundown, just so...
I was born and raised in LA, and sometimes I say that I left Pacoima because I wanted to stop hearing the helicopters, and all last week there were helicopters above campus. All last week. With all of the Free Speech Week events and threats of the Milo Yiannopoulos and sort of Steve Bannon and culture types coming to campus. And so there's a lot of activism on both sides.
Who's bringing them in? Where's all of this, the organizational energy for these outside speakers coming from on Berkeley campus?
So there's a group called the Berkeley Free Patriots. I want to say, but it's very unclear who is in this group. Some people would argue that they're basically only a group of like five students. Other argue that it's that it might have a larger base if only people were free to express more conservative views, I guess, on the Berkeley campus. They're proposing them as speakers, and it just so happened, or I don't think not just so happened, that the chancellor designated this year the year of free speech, right? So there are many other things that this year could have been designated. It could have been designated the year of social justice or various other things, but it became the year of free speech. And so along with that was a list of activities and speakers that would come in, and the Berkeley Free Patriots seized on this as an opportunity to bring tried to bring some of these big name people, but of course the biggest name people didn't come.
And weren't even planning to come. Like there was a quote, a journalist reached Charles Murray, and he just said, "I've never heard of this and I wouldn't go even if I did know about it because I hate Milo." but in terms of like where does this come from, my understanding is that it's mostly a troll operation from the Mercers. Who are the
Mercers?
Well, it's kind of what, they're people who God put on earth to make you realize how much you should have appreciated the Cokes. the Mercers are, it's a father and daughter, billionaire. Mm. And, they basically were the billionaires who, so like the Cokes wanted to push the Republican Party in a more libertarian direction. and the Mercers want to push it in a more Trumpist direction. And they were a big part of the reason for unifying the Republican Party behind Trump. And for instance, they are the reason that Ted Cruz had to kind of suck it up and end up endorsing Trump and completely throw away whatever vestiges of dignity he had left.
Well, I will say that the politics were about the people coming around, but it was also about sort of, I don't know, I have really seen the campus take a different turn in, since the Trump election in terms of who is coming in on campus. Like, I had never seen flyers for white supremacist groups since I've been here, and I've seen now a few.
Really?
Just last week, there or 2 weeks ago, right after the Yiannopoulos talk was canceled. Oh, no, last week. There were posters on campus, wanted posters with the pictures of Berkeley faculty.
Really?
Saying they supported terrorism. And yeah. So, I mean, it was like targeting Judith Butler, a lot of our humanities professors, sort of just... was a chilling effect.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know if you guys saw, but, you know, this is happening at Michigan as well. I mean, someone sent me copies of the flyers, right? So, you know, it's U of M, black enrollment, 5%. Average black IQ equals 85. Average white IQ equals 100. Do the math. Nature is racist, not the system. That's just one of them.
Oh.
And, you know, which I think is so shocking. And also at Berkeley, considering that, you know, your states don't allow the use of affirmative action in your admissions processes in your state universities.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, this is the argument that, you know, that these groups, you know, are making. Like at the bottom, there's like, you know, altright.com, therightstuff.biz, right? So.
Christina, can you tell us, for those of us who aren't plugged into the Hispanic community or Spanish-speaking media, how is all of this being processed by the Hispanic community in America, from what you gather in the mass media?
Campus politics?
Or just the entire, this whole Trumpism and the right wing and the backlash.
Oh, I think, so, you know, I have a lot of problems with Latino media in terms of the way it's reporting on a range of issues. But to its credit, historically, it has been a mainstay for reporting on up-to-date issues about immigration reform and immigration reform politics. And so when the rest of the media is distracted by whatever Trump is tweeting about lunch or whatever it's out there, they're doggedly persistent on, you know, what is happening in immigration reform politics, what are states doing, where different raids are happening, things of the sort. So they've been vigilant, and I think they're much more vigilant now. And it's not just on that too. They're consistently now covering what is actually happening in Puerto Rico. You know, is aid coming in? Where is it going? Much, you know, in a much more comprehensive manner than any other mainstream media outlet around.
You have a new project in the works, I understand, about immigration in the Trump era. Can you tell us a little bit about the direction that your work is taking?
Yes, I've got two projects. So the one that's more particular to this one is basically just racial politics in working class neighborhoods, how everyday Americans are thinking about race in everyday lives, both at the local level and how they're understanding what's going on in national politics. So that's an incredibly new project that stemmed just from a huge frustration about not having or not seeing in the literature really a really good, effective, qualitative approach to what mainly political scientists have been studying, which is how do people understand racial politics. So I think sociologists have often understood how we understand racial boundaries, and perhaps they connect this sometimes to broader questions about the fate of the nation or the direction of the administration, but they haven't centralized the idea of politics. And so this is my first foray into trying to bring the apparatus of the qualitative sociologist into the discussion on race and politics. So I think in political sciences, where we have these more overt discussions about what people are thinking about in terms of the fate of the nation, the effectiveness of their elected officials, about what policies are important, I think that's where they centralize those discussions. But they don't have a good understanding, really, about the way people are thinking about racial boundaries, who's in their group, who's outside of their group, and how this influences the way that they are thinking about these issues about politics and where the country should be going. So this is a new project that tries to bring in, I think, the best of qualitative sociological research and these understandings of racial boundaries to the central question of how do people make sense of politics. But I don't think this is just sort of a lack of our understanding about racial politics and the working class in America. I think generally, more broadly, we can have this discussion about how the working class is thinking about race, you know, the connection between race and politics in sort of Western Europe as well and in other places.
Well, what's your view on that?
I think a lot of the political world was taken aback with the rise of these nationalist movements, right, with Brexit, with the rise of nationalist parties in other places, the popularity of, Le Pen in France and everywhere else, right? And I think this is a good time to reassess this question, not just, with the tools that we have, such as survey research, the way we've done it, but I think with really going into, with a battery of sort of ethnographic observations and also sort of qualitative research methods, to really asking how are people thinking about who belongs, who doesn't belong, what are the borders of the nation, and how this is coinciding with their just basic views on, economic policy or immigration policy in general.
So that's a useful perspective, right, to see it as part of a worldwide trend towards populism, where, you see this similar issue of a shift towards an increasing popularity of the populist right, taking popularity away from the far left, the center left, and the more neoliberal right. And you can kind of think about why that is. I mean, I'd be interested in your opinions, but what I see is it's going to be some combination of a backlash to global integration and an increase in migration in many countries. You see an increase in migration in, over the last 20 years and over the last 50 years in the United States. You've also seen that in the European Union, including internal migration from within the European Union and the recent migrant crisis stemming from, the collapse of Libya and the Syrian civil war and all that sort of thing. And then on top of that, you also have, it's not just a backlash to migration, it's also a backlash to neoliberalism writ large and the idea of free market policies. All those things are creating this backlash. And, one way to interpret it would be that it reflects kind of a democracy gap in that these policies, which, maybe everybody on this podcast likes them, maybe we like some of them, not others. But they were definitely never popular with the median voter.
Don't you find it interesting? It's almost like neoliberalism and what we talk about as liberalism are somehow coalescing. And I've heard arguments that the main fissure in politics is going to be nativism versus some type of globalism. And I find it interesting to see that, the people who are interested in globalization are very much in line with those who are in support of, multiculturalism on the left, for example.
Still, in the rise of sort of nativism and all of these insecurities, I think one of the biggest things is people are just concerned about everyday living, right? Everyday economics, still, even among, for example, in the United States, even among Latinos, the number one issue that's important to them is the fate of the economy, more so than immigration. And so I think everyday people are still just way more interested in, are they going to be able to sort of provide for their families and things of the sort? It's because this isn't solvable because of politics at hand, that nativism becomes much more readily accessible as a form of politics that they can latch onto, right? And so, it becomes opposed just very simply as a nativism versus global open borders argument to the everyday person, right?
Do you think it's going to disappear if times were to get better? Like that the nativism is sort of a reaction, of that the commitment, the ideological commitment to nativism, I'm getting from you, you think it's not particularly high. It's just that people are very concerned with their personal lives and they're grasping for something. And nativism is just one perceived life jacket.
Yeah. I mean, I'm also, so a lot of my research also looks at Spain, and Spain is really interesting to me right now.
What's going on in Spain?
I mean, I know it's in the news with all this sort of Catalan independence stuff, but it's been interesting for a while. So if you look at Spain compared to the rest of Western Europe, there's a couple of things that are really interesting. One, it's got one of the lowest rates of nationalism. So people don't really, you know, more people feel really strongly about being German than Spaniards think really strongly about being Spanish. Got a lower rate of nationalism. One of the only countries that really doesn't have an organized, independently motivated anti-immigration party or nativist party. So lots of other Western European countries have it. Spain doesn't. Doesn't mean there isn't sort of everyday anti-immigrant sentiment. It just means it hasn't been institutionalized into a party. But yet Spain also still has record levels of high unemployment. It has all of these other, it's still trying to recover from the recession. It's got all of these sort of economic markers that you would think would lead it towards this nativist form of politics, but it actually doesn't. So it's the only one that I've been thinking about as this real puzzle.
Well, there. What do you think it is? You think it's sort of a legacy of, you know, the Franco years, or?
I think it's a combination of things, but it's worth thinking about, right? What is this outlier doing when everyone else is moving towards this sort of populist, to the right politics? Spain is still in the background. And I think a couple of things. One is, what is actually, you know, the idea that, you know, many Spaniards themselves are tied to immigration, right? So if you look at Spain, the population of Spain in the 1970s, about a quarter of Spaniards were out living in other places, mainly in Latin America, but also in other places in Western Europe. So lots of Spanish families have ties to have the experience of immigration. I think second, you know, the fact that national identity is low is because regional identities are so high, as we see here. You know, as we see with the Catalan issue and as we see with the Basque issue, I mean, Spain since democracy in the late 70s has really tried to experiment with this much more multicultural identity in which sort of various different languages and histories are folded into this umbrella of the broader Spanish identity. So, you know, even in places where the language is Spanish, where it's not Catalan or something else that's distinct, like in Andalusia, people have a much stronger Andalus identity than they have as a Spanish identity. And I think third, you know, the rise of immigration there, that's really a response to, you know, Spanish demographics. I mean, Spaniards are aging and they're not having kids. So, and since about the 1990s, it's been Latin Americans that have really come into the country to take care of things. In, you know, they're entering domestic work, they're construction workers, things of the sort. And so I think, and, you know, places like Catalonia, for example, have really tried to embrace immigration as a future, given this sort of demographic crisis. You see, for example, Catalan parties, those for independence and those against independence, trying really hard to mobilize the Latino vote on either side. Sort of with this idea that you are, you know, those for independence try to mobilize the Latino Catalan population as you are Latino Catalanes, or Catalonia is a history of immigrants that have always come in. We've always had flows of people. So it's this new form of Catalan identity based on multiculturalism and sort of some narrative of embracing immigration. So just think it's fascinating to also think of Bain is bucking the trend.
Do you think that it has something to do with a shared common heritage? Like, for example, I don't sense that Americans are very unhappy about Canadian immigration, even though there's quite a few of us here. How do the Spaniards treat North African immigration, for example?
But
Canadian, go home.
Yeah, so if you look, so we're just looking at Catalonia. I mean, it's a really particular time. The fact that it's just really right in the middle of this moment of, you know, where the question of Catalan independence is much more heightened than it has been for a long time. And so because of this, I think parties on both ends, those for independence and those for not, and, you know, it's not the left and the right, because there are, you know, conservative, you know, and liberal parties on both sides of the issue. They just really are, you know, the independence vote is so tight that they really see just any vote. So any immigrant vote as a difference maker. So whether that be the Latino immigrant vote, which has a fast track to citizenship. So Latinos can be voters much quicker than African immigrants, for example. But they're seeing just any amount of votes that are, that can be received, are important for them in this decisive vote.
So a second ago, Christina was saying that, you know, there's, you don't have the regional parties taking a distinctive perspective on immigration. And my understanding is that that's not how it works in some other countries where you have kind of a regional movement, that very often the regional movements tend to resist immigrants because they see the immigrants as more likely to caucus with the ethnic majority, especially linguistically, right? So, Joe, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that the Quebecois parties tend not to be terribly fond of immigration, except for Francophone immigration. So like, they wouldn't want Chinese people who speak English to move to Montreal, but they'd be totally happy with Haitians or something.
I'm not an expert, but my naive impression is yes.
Yeah, no, I think what's different here, so that is true. But I think what's different here is here's where both sides really manipulate history and really manipulate this idea of heritage, ethnic or racial heritage, whatever you want to call it. So on the independence side, you will often hear, so I've got a piece in the Du Bois Review that's coming out soon, in which I talk about some of the narratives that political parties on both sides of Catalonia are using. And on the pro-independence side, what you often hear is, you know, it was the Spaniards that colonized the Americas. They were the ones that did the atrocities. We're the Catalans. We're different. You know, come join us. Be Latino Catalanes. Be part of this new nation, this future, this multicultural mix of people that sees it as different. Whereas you've got parties that range the ideological spectrum on both sides. But if you on the side that's for staying within Spain, the anti-independence side, you often have a narrative of, you know, you came to migrate to the motherland, you came to migrate to your Spanish heritage, you know, stick with us, you know, stick to coming to a place in which that supports your culture, that values your culture, that values the ideals of Catholicism, and that values really the speaking of the Spanish language. The idea of language is so important here. And so you have this spinning the story about history and ethnicity. I mean, some of the pro-independence parties have even put out their own history books in which they try to separate the Spanish role in the conquest from the Catalan role in the conquest.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.